Well, this is Matt Hale bringing you an unusual version of the Art Monthly talk show recorded during COVID-19 on Zoom. And we have three guests, and they're all recorded separately this time, as opposed to being all in the studio together where they might ask each other questions or not, depending. This time that won't happen because it's just me and them one at a time. And the first guest I have with me today is John Douglas Miller, who is a critic, writer, and poet. You've written a piece in the current April issue of Art Monthly, issue 435, we called No New York.
I think what I'm starting to do, and I would say it really is only a start. I think this is, I think in some ways the piece is actually quite, looking for a kinder word than confused, but maybe I'll just have to go for confused, because it's the start of trying to think through a set of commitments that I've had for some time that don't really sit very comfortably together, and it's trying to think of a way of making them fit together in some way. In a way, there was two maybe quotes that I kind of had in mind when I started writing it. One was from Pasolini, when he said that the Italian Communist Party should become the party of the lumpen proletariat, and we can maybe come back to why that was important to me later.
Okay.
And the second is more of a formal question. That's a quote from Anne Carson, where when she was asked about how she writes essays, she said that she puts three different books that have no relationship together on her desk and then tries to work out how they fit together.
Right.
Well, because that was kind of in some ways, that was in some ways the organizing principle for this piece. But the maybe the most important underlying issue for the piece around which maybe some of these things constellate is trying to make a case for why it might be important to think about that moment in New York's history, in its cultural and political history, why that might be important to think about that again. Because I think, of course, that downtown scene has been massively romanticized. It probably has, you know, second only to 1920s Paris in terms of its mythography or mythology. And so I think there's an understandable hesitation to go back there, because it seems that even people who try to do serious historiographic work on that period end up just producing hagiography of one type or another. It seems almost impossible to escape the romanticism of that period. Although I talk about a couple of examples of pieces or books in the piece that I think do manage to do very interesting work on that period.
What's the problem with romanticizing it? Is what? I mean, just nostalgia without value, you mean? Or
well, I think it has ended up often being romanticized through the lenses of fashion or music. And there was, you know, I think some of the more serious work that was being done ends up being thrown into that kind of melting pot of fashion and the mud club and everything else. I mean, I'm thinking about the Basquiat show a couple of years ago at the Barbican, which, you know, you walked in and the first thing you saw was a massive projection of kind of the New York downtown demimonde, you know, Madonna and various others partying at the mud club, and that's kind of become the lens through which that period is seen. But I think that there's, you know, good reasons to go back and really think about, and this actually maybe speaks in some way to Morgan Quaintance's piece, because I think in both cases there's a desire to look at what's going on, to put it in maybe slightly crude Marxian terms, to look at what's going on at the base rather than the superstructure. What are the conditions under which these things were being produced and in which they were reacting to? And I think he has something similar to say about that in relation to the to decolonialization. And of course, what was happening at that time in New York was the city had almost gone bankrupt, and in order for it to continue, a cabal of of bankers, basically, probably for the first time since the situation in Chile in the early 1970s, this was the first time that the kind of neoliberal project was tried in a so-called first world country. And New York was the test case for that. Neoliberal reforms were brought in by this cabal of bankers when the city went bust. And of course, that's the background against which the whole downtown supermerged. It's on one level, it's the condition of possibility for the downtown scene, but it's also something that, you know, certain artists were aware of, or at least reflecting in some way. And I think it's worth thinking about how those things intersect, and maybe that's the point at which the piece kind of begins. Maybe we could talk more about the question of, maybe a way into this is to think about this question around bohemianism.
Right.
I think what there is there's in the piece there's a kind of series of divides, I think, that I'm trying to think together. One would be criticality and aestheticism. And then on the other side of that, there would be a kind of critical theory inflected approach to thinking about art on the one side, and maybe a more Deleuzian approach on the other. And then the kind of third divide is between, sort of sitting under that divide, is between this kind of issue in Marxism that I'm thinking about, and this idea of the lumpen proletariat. So maybe here we could return to that Pasolini quote that I said at the beginning. Yeah. So obviously there's a famous quote in the 18th Brumaire by Marx, where he discusses the lumpen proletariat as ruse, pickpockets, thieves, petty criminals, and, as he puts it, what the French call la bohème. And he effectively condemns the lumpen proletariat as those that will be reactionary under revolutionary conditions. They can't be trusted. Whereas you have, on the other side, you have the proletariat itself, which is this sort of is the part of that can be brought to revolutionary consciousness, as it were. And I'm interested partly, and I think this is sort of underlying the piece in some ways, is to start a kind of defense of bohemianism as a site of knowledge production and vitality of cultural production, and that perhaps it's almost impossible to imagine the kind of bohemian milieu that downtown New York once represented. And part of the project would be to measure why that kind of milieu has become impossible under current conditions. So in a sense, one of the things the piece is doing is trying to measure the distance as well, the historical distance from that moment to now. And that's maybe where the Whitney show comes in as an example, because what I'm trying to talk about there is the fact that that show effectively kind of conservatively historicized von Horowitz's work. It kind of contained it in a certain way. It didn't appeal to the fact that a lot of the issues that von Horowitz was dealing with at the time are still very much live issues. And so part of the sort of raison d'etre of the piece is to try and think about how some of the energies, some of those activist political but also cultural energies, might be done justice to in the present. And again, that maybe returns to the Osborne part, because one of the ways in which I imagine that can be done justice to is by utilizing a kind of radical philosophy of history, one found in Walter Benjamin, to start to, I mean, the sort of broader project is to take Benjamin's philosophy of history and apply it to that downtown moment.
Can you possibly say how that would be specific? I mean, just an example of a different treatment that the Whitney didn't do that you might consider they should have done, as an example. Is that possible? I mean, what was missing, say, from the show that would have changed how people saw him?
Well, for a start, I think that they would have needed to appeal to the critical potential of his work in the present, rather than containing it as this bygone historical moment. I mean, I think what underlies the Whitney show in some ways is a historical narrative which says there was this moment in downtown New York, then the AIDS crisis happened. But in some way underlying that is this kind of the moral arc of history. But in the end, America turns out all right because that happened in the past, but, you know, we're okay now kind of thing. Whilst at the same time, obviously trying to make this, I mean, I think underlying it too is this sort of claim that, a quiet claim that Vonarovitz's work is of importance in the Trump moment, but it never really dealt with why that might be the case in any kind of strong critical way. It's just sort of this sort of loose appeal to some idea of the political in the work, but without really dealing with what it was, you know, actually that was important in the work, which is why, of course, ACT UP protesters protested the Whitney show itself, because ACT UP wasn't really mentioned at all in the show. And of course, that's one of the most important, for Vonarovitz himself, I think that would probably be the most important, one of the most important things to have, you know, brought up, that this is still a live issue, that people are still dying of AIDS, that, you know, Trump himself shut down various bodies that deal with that. So,
is having a show of just one artist.
Well, there is also that, yeah.
Really wrong in the first place, in that he was so involved as a community person and with so many other people all the time, even though he didn't work individually, it was always placed in quite particular contexts. Because you talk about context as being quite important for.
Well, I think that's absolutely true. And I think that again speaks to the narrative of downtown that there's been, that it's this very kind of individualistic, kind of ludically creative scene. When in fact, of course, there's all sorts of modes of collective action going on around it. And especially, you know, in terms of the politics of the day. And that's kind of sidelined in the name of presenting Vonarovitz as this kind of, you know, one-off particular political artistic genius of the downtown moment, and separating him out from that in some way. And yeah, as you say, I think that in itself is a kind of reactionary curatorial move. Is the hard, I mean, this is why, you know, a stronger kind of critical frame is necessary. I think why you kind of might appeal to Benjamin or something like that is because, you know, actually these people's work ask a lot of questions of the present and you know, difficult questions about the present, which these shows really occlude, I think, and that is, and this is where I think it does speak to very much to Morgan's piece, because I think in the end what's going on is that there's a sort of surface level discussion of representation, but it doesn't really get back to who's really in control of these things in some way. You know, I mean, I think in Morgan's piece, I think in all these, examples, what's going on is there's a sort of art world backslapping of saying, you know, we're appealing to these very important contemporary issues. But I think, you know, what Morgan's piece does is, and mine to some degree, is to say, well, but what's actually behind that? What are the stronger, more difficult political questions? Who's still really in charge, you know, at the level of institutions, who's running them? Well, it's still the same people when it comes down to it. You know, it's all very well to make sure that your panel has, you know, examples of various minorities on it, but, you know, the person running the institution and the people who are providing the money for the institution to run, you know, the people who, for example, the Serpentine is appealing to, Mike Bloomberg being the biggest one, for example, but, you know, a lot of others, it's very easy to put on a representative front, but you need to go down below those questions. And I think these artists, Kathy Acker, Vonarovitz, and, you know, many others from that particular moment, what I'm trying to do, I think, is retrieve their work for this moment to ask those difficult questions, or to show how their work did ask those difficult questions and wasn't just a kind of I don't know, it wasn't just this example of this one-off kind of singular protest, that it was asking actually difficult critical questions, as well as, I mean, what's interesting in some ways about especially von Horowitz's work is that it operates across all these different levels, because of course he was an important activist, but that the art isn't just, you know, an art of activism. It's asking difficult critical questions about art itself and about how it might perform certain critical roles, as well as being a kind of activist.
I mean, I saw a video of when David is he's diagnosed with HIV, and he gives a performance where talking about his anger, and he gets quite angry, and then so the art for me there, which it is an art performance, is a helping him deal with his situation.
Yeah, absolutely. But also that, you know, von Horowitz's work and life was, you know, profoundly anti-institutional.
Yeah.
At every level. I mean, at the institution of government, at the art institution, you know, anything. It is by definition, it's definitionally anti-institutional. And I think, you know, especially in the case of the Whitney, that they fundamentally failed to do any to do justice to that, or to question their own position in relation to his own anti-institutional status. Yeah. I think Kathy Acker is a slightly more complicated issue there, but I mean, that's the bottom line. I think is that it's still the case that institutions are trying to provide themselves with both a kind of political right on this, but also a kind of frisson of anti-institutional revolt.
Shall we leave it on that last lovely word?
Yes, that's
I'm joined now by Andrew Wilson, who has very kindly come on the programme. And he is the Senior Curator of Modern and Contemporary British Art and Archives at Tate Britain, and also has in the past been, I think it was Deputy Editor of Art Monthly.
Latterly Deputy Editor, yeah.
Yes, yeah, and written for Art Monthly for many years prior to that, and still, I think, just written precisely why we're on talking to you now, written again. And this time you've written an obituary, which is a sad thing to have to have done, but it's on Genesis Breyer P-Orridge, who lived from 1950 to 2020, Andrew, and who did know. That's not the name that she began with. She began as a he and was known with a different name. What was that?
Jen's original name, birth name, was Neil Megson, and Genesis P-Orridge is very much the invention of Neil Megson. And I think certainly after a number of years, I would imagine that Jen had to wonder where Neil was. You know, in a sense, Neil, as a teenager, inventing this persona of Genesis P-Orridge, was very much controlling the idea of Genesis P-Orridge. And at some point, Genesis took over. You know, Genesis created something bigger than Genesis P-Orridge in a way, and was stronger than Neil Megson. I mean, I think that one of the many fascinating aspects of Jen's career and life is this constant play of identity, shifting identity fluidly. And in a way, one of the early guides for Neil was his discovery of one of Max Ernst's collage novels, La Femme Sans Tête, The Hundred-Headed Woman.
Oh, it's 100.
And this was one of a number of collage novels that Max Ernst made in the late 20s and into the 1930s, where he would take 19th century engravings and collage, make these collages which were, you know, intended for publication, and intended for publication in such a way that you couldn't really see where the cuts were between the different bits of engraving that were collaged together. And effectively, you know, a hundred-headed woman, it's the tales of this hundred-headed woman, is almost like a recipe book, a visual recipe book for shifting identity and what the possibilities of shifting identity may be. And it was shortly after Neil found this book that he had had the idea to create this persona for himself, for Neil, which was Genesis Peorage, Genesis for creation, Peorage for sustenance. And this allowed him, it's sort of the creation of a new identity gives license to what you might do. And, you know, part of that is a sense of questioning about what society gives to you and what, you know, the body that you have and the mind that you have gives to you and how you can alter it. And in a sense, this is, you know, thinking back to the Max Ernst, this idea of altering one's identity is also very much a form of collage. And I think when Jen and with her partner, Lady J, struck out on what they called this Pandrogyny project, where they would merge, in a sense, merge their identities potentially, but also creates this almost third being, that also itself was a form of collage of the body in a way, collage of identity.
And that third thing that William Burroughs and is used the term very similar to that, didn't he?
Well, William Burroughs and Brian Geisen. I mean, Brian Geisen. British-American cosmopolitan poet, who is a friend of William Burroughs, is in the 1950s and 60s, very much discovered,
right,
I guess is the best way of describing it, the idea of the cut-up.
Yes.
You know, it's apocryphal story that I'm sure isn't apocryphal at all, but true, that he was in his studio cutting through some mount board and cut through the newspapers that were underneath the mount board, and then found that he'd spliced together these fantastical phrases which seemed to have possibilities that William Burroughs also recognized. And they coined this idea that, I mean, they collaborated on cut-ups, but also coined this idea that the product of the cut-up, the product of their activity together, was in effect a third mind.
Yes.
And the work isn't the result of William Burroughs and Brian Geisen, it is the result of this third mind.
Yes, and that influenced Jen as well, that whole kind of third mind and other extra thing external to your original being.
Well, I mean, William Burroughs was, as was Brian Geisen, an important figure for Jen as her career unfolded and her life unfolded, because, you know, both Burroughs and Geisen offered opportunities the work offered opportunities and confirmation for taking a path that was not fixed, that wasn't fixed by media, wasn't fixed by process, wasn't fixed by accepted categories, but somehow existed between media. And I think there's, you know, in a way, this idea of the intermedia or the transmedia is also very much a reflection and goes hand in hand with the idea of collage and that sort of collaboration as well, sort of being between people. And Jen's work always seemed to perhaps work best as within that sort of fluctuation between the individual, Jen or Neil, and the group that he or she found themselves in, whether it was the group around Coon Transmissions, the performance group that Jen worked with through the late 60s and 70s, or Throbbing Gristle, or whether it was thinking about the Temple of Psychic Youth, or thinking more directly about the Pandrogyny project itself, which was very much this sense of the individual and the group or pair.
Yeah, I mean, I did think it was quite interesting the word transmedia being, and then obviously there's now big and he got him and she got involved with transgender.
Yeah,
the word, I don't know the origin of the word trans, but is it transient or is it transfer? It does it mean to cross over?
I think the whole the positioning of Jen and Lady J's Pandrogyny project from different points of view is one that is absolutely about gender and about that idea of a fluidity of gender being something that can be attained, and also something that is sort of almost beyond gender. And I think for Jen, it seemed to fluctuate sort of at different times, the significance. But, you know, I think at the end, the question of is it or isn't it about gender? Yes, it is about gender, absolutely. But in being about gender, it's about a bigger thing, which is pretty much to do with the individual within society and accepting or not accepting social and physical norms. You know, do you accept the life that you have, the life that's given to you, the life that you make, or do you actually make that life yourself? And do you are you happy about the primitive body that we inhabit as a kind of a shell, or do you see ways in which it can be modified and changed and improved on? And that, you know, in a way, those then become questions, you know, I guess, of, you know, questions of evolution almost, if you want to take it that far.
Well, and you could say it's political in a personal sense.
Yeah.
You are fighting against given some preordained states that you're supposed to adopt.
Yeah.
So that's
I mean, do you conform to the social stereotyping of the family unit as it's understood to be, or do you not?
Yeah, and the grammar school you go to, or the university which he dropped out of in Hull, or he also went to a commune called run by David Madalla, or set up by him, I think, Transmedia Explorations, which. That was.
Yeah, I think that, you know, a place of, you know, a situation like that would have been very formative for Jen, because because it's a group situation, a commune that sets itself up as a family, but absolutely in opposition to the social norms of what families usually are.
Yeah, I can't imagine it wasn't. I don't know a lot about it, and we don't need to go into it too much. What I was just going to say before I forget was also, so when the Pandrogyny project, he has a partner, and they spend a lot of money, as an aside in a way, to become and look quite similar. And then eventually she dies, or
yeah,
doesn't she? And then, but somehow that's almost like accepted as, well, she hasn't gone. He's sort of like, mm-hmm. right, they're saying, what was his approach to that death and the life after it?
Well, Jen's approach to it was, in a way, pragmatic and spiritual in equal measure, I think, is one way of thinking about it. You know, I mean, Lady J died very tragically and very suddenly in 2007, I think. Yes, I think it was in 2007. Yeah. And so for the last
12 years
or so, thanks, my mathematics is absolutely hopeless. For the last 12 years or so, Jen found herself very much, you know, you could say alone, but actually she wasn't alone, because she had already gone through this process of merging with Lady J and creating this third person, and that they were still unified in that quest, however separated physically they might were. Lady J was in the immaterial realm, and Jen, she was in the physical realm, and, you know, I guess now they are both together in the immaterial realm.
What interests me is that it worked for them. I mean, I don't know if they used the word love, but they certainly were very close and found, and in a way, whatever way you look at it, they found a way of dealing with something which a lot of people find quite problematic.
I think they were very, you know, they were very together. They treated this really seriously. Yeah. Obviously, you don't alter your dollars. you don't alter your bodies in that way, without it being a serious thing. But they're also very playful about it as well.
Yeah,
I mean, I remember, you know, seeing them shortly after, you know, sort of a few months after they'd had their first surgery, which was sort of breast implants, and they were walking down Old Street in London, dressed in matching camouflage suits. I mean, they were, you know, like two-piece suits, but camouflage, yeah. And being very present, obviously making their presence very obvious, yeah. And you know, they didn't look, strictly speaking, you know, as if they were applying themselves to the social norms, so to speak, but they were doing this in a very, you know, very serious and very playful way, in the same way that, you know, another of their kind of characters that they adopted as sort of quasi twins, or, yeah, I mean, I guess in a sense, one other way of thinking about this is as the merging of twins, as kind of French chanteurs, kind of siblings dressed in hoop jerseys and berets. You right. know, looking very, what's the word, gamine and chic.
The only thing I'd say is that sometimes the best art projects and artists are the hardest to present when they died.
But I think there's also the sense, you know, sort of what was Jen's legacy, what was Jen's greatest work? And I think, you know, she always found it very hard to acknowledge an idea of legacy. And I think it's because, you know, legacy is often seen, you know, the history of art is often written from the point of view of objects, you know, objects that are left behind rather than projects. And I think that, you know, the bigger thing about Jen's work isn't so much individual objects, but actually a kind of an outlook and an ethos and, you know, a set of projects.
Yes. Thank you very much. Hi, this is Matt Hale again, and I'm joined now by Morgan Quaintance, who is an artist and writer based in London and has written for Art Monthly many times. And he's written a feature in the April issue of Art Monthly. That's April 2020. And I think I've said it already, but the issue is number 435. And we'd love you to subscribe to that magazine and any others. And you can do it digitally or in print. Now, Morgan, your piece in the magazine is called Decolonizing Decolonialism. And basically, however, that's not your title. I think we add them. And you, however, are fundamentally writing about the decolonial project, which I understand the term decolonial began being used in relation to Cecil Rhodes' statue in South Africa. But I'll stop, and I think that's when you perhaps might best begin to explain, because that's the beginning of your feature in the magazine, isn't it?
Yeah, so basically, just broadly, let me just provide a little bit more context. So what I've been trying to do over the past sort of 2 years is to track the, I guess, the introduction and the operation of a new sort of institutional sensibility. And that institutional sensibility, broadly speaking, is I'm terming it the performance of progression. So we've gone from, I'm simplifying, but we've gone from maybe an interest in object-oriented ontology and post-internet art and all the sort of leftover detritus of what happened in the 90s and noughties, so relational aesthetics, designers as art, all that sort of stuff. We've gone from that stuff holding sway at the beginning of the 2010s, and in the middle of the 2010s, we get this sudden political crisis. A political crisis in that these large events, large-scale events like the EU referendum and the election of Trump in America and also the so-called rise of the far right make it difficult for the art world to ignore politics anymore. So what it has to do is find a way to engage with politics, but in ways that's a kind of risk-free way of engaging in politics. Now, why does it need to be risk-free? Well, it needs to be risk-free because a lot of these larger institutions and then also smaller institutions, organizations, and collectives who operate in these in the sector are in some ways complicit with these larger political developments that are adversely affecting populations. So the main strategy that I've been talking about in a lot of different articles that for them to tackle this is to take an approach called cosmetic diversity, right? So cosmetic diversity focuses on a kind of facelift of institutions as opposed to structural change. And the facelift of institutions allows the art world to kind of recuperate itself by appearing to be engaging in politics, appearing to be progressive, but not actually being progressive. Now, another way that it's doing this is through this adoption of decolonization as a kind of critical strategy. Now, I used 2015 as one of the moments where this emerged because I was tracking it to the Rhodes Must Fall movement, which took place, I think, predominantly in Cape Town in South Africa, which was centered on a group of students who were at a university who wanted to remove this statue of Cecil Rhodes because obviously Rhodes is, well, an unapologetic racist and somebody who laid the foundations for, I guess, apartheid in what we can't really get into that, but laid the foundations for really adverse conditions in South Africa that we know as apartheid, segregation of people, and the widespread racism that was rife in the country and probably still is to a greater extent. So basically, these students were asking for this monument to be pulled down, and in the wake of that, this term decolonization became a strategy that people were starting to adopt, or decolonizing was something people began to be talking about. And what I noticed is that this almost, in this rush for institutions to perform progression, it became what I've termed a radicalizing prefix. So what I mean by that is that it's a word you can just attach to basically any activity, that and that will have the transformative effect of making that activity suddenly seem radical, anti-institutional, anti-capitalist, anti-neoliberal, and like unquestionably progressive. So I was being sort of a bit trite and provocative in the opening, but I mentioned that like in any given week, you might hear people calling for calls to decolonize fashion, art history, university curricula, RuPaul's Drag Race, the ballet, or the BAFTAs, or indeed the Oscars.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things that people will notice once I've run through that list of things that could be decolonized is that they actually have very little to do with actual literal colonization. So if we're talking about actual literal colonization, it would be the takeover of one country's sovereignty, infrastructure, natural resources, and general populace by a foreign power. That is actual literal colonization. But in this new order, decolonization essentially means a move away from monoculture to multiculture. And what that does again, then, you see, is it ushers in an initiative that should have been addressed 30 something years ago and has not been addressed, and is now being like pushed in under the veil of this a pseudo radicality that the words decolonization, when used as a prefix, allows institutions to enact.
So you're saying it's tokenism, really?
No. I'm saying decolonization is as it's understood institutionally, and I think is then propagated amongst different actors in the field, so artists, curators, critics. Decolonization in the West, let's say, is recognized as a kind of largely symbolic gesture. And the symbolic gesture has, if you look at it broadly now, is basically about having like more a more diverse workforce, or a more diverse roster, or a more diverse art historical canon. And it doesn't actually tackle real and literal colonization, number one. And then number two, it doesn't tackle how arts organizations and institutions are actually complicit in the continued legacy of real and literal colonization.
Yes.
And I characterize the real and literal continuance of colonization by drawing attention to three ways that we can see that this is still operating in former colonies. So in the form of structural adjustment programs that are imposed on former colonies who needed to get loans from the IMF, in the form of imposed currency. So if you in certain Francophone West African countries, they have to use something called the West African franc, which is the acronym is CFA. And the CFA is tied to the euro, which makes it really, really difficult for these countries to develop. We can't really go into the ins and outs of that. And then the last, but I guess not least, strategy is the facility of capital flight. And this basically makes Africa a net exporter of revenue to the West. You know, many, many people, especially libertarians, free marketeers, always try to look critically at this system of aid that's going to African countries from the West. But in actual fact, Africa exports far more revenue than is than it receives from Western aid. So all of these like sort of bureaucratic indirect systems that aren't basically functioning along the level of like face-to-face prejudice or segregation or people being barred from opportunities. These are the new territory through which the legacy of colonization is continuing, but they're all places that decolonization, under the Western sort of symbolic understanding of the term, are ignored.
Right, okay. And you give other examples as well, where you talk about offshore funds and people using those and the financial system, the spider web of the City of London.
So this is a super, super complex territory, right? But I wanted to draw attention to how this is functioning by looking specifically at institutions. So when I'm talking about institutions, I don't just mean like museums or like the Tate or Chisenhale. Like, an institution can be a magazine. An institution, I guess, is another way of talking about any kind of corporate body, and any, and I don't mean commercial, I just mean any collection of people who work within an organization that has sort of set rules and procedures and a specific identity and like a remit. So what I was doing was saying, okay, let's look at some case studies, right? So when you write a feature with a specific topic, we have to illustrate it in action. So one of the ways I was doing that was looking at Freeze magazine. Now, I don't know if it's common knowledge. I've written a lot about this, a lot about how not only is the magazine a huge corporate entity that has, a monopoly on how art is displayed, how it's purchased, how it's written about, and how it's commissioned in the UK. Not only does it have that, but it also receives funding from Arts Council England under the sort of admissible fiction that it has a non-profit arm. Yeah. So for anyone who's spent any time looking at the system of taxation, they'll know that returns are not just measured in terms of capital, but returns are also measured in terms of I'm gonna have to search for this term quickly.
Yeah, I can always. Don't worry.
Yeah, so you can have actual physical returns or intangible returns. Right. So let's say a physical return would be monetary, and intangible comes in the form of like brand enrichment.
Yeah.
So those are both recognised. If you look at corporate tax returns, these are both physical assets and intangible assets are both recognised, right? Yeah. So I'd say that there's no such thing as a non-profit arm of the Freeze corporate empire.
Yes.
Anyway, the point being is that Freeze have a number of subsidiary companies, and they all account to a parent company called Denmark Street Limited that is sited in Jersey. Now, Jersey is a notorious offshore tax haven that exists within this thing called the British Crown Dependencies. And a lot of people use it, number one, to, avoid paying the right amount of tax, but also to use their facility of financial secrecy. And this is the admitted reason, apparently, why Freeze use Jersey, is to keep their finances secret from so-called competitors. But also it has a nice side effect of keeping them secret from us. So we can't scrutinize exactly how it is that the organization's functioning. But not only that, the Denmark Street Limited is a subsidiary company of a company called IMG Worldwide, I think, which itself accounts in Delaware, which is an onshore tax haven in the US. So you can see there's a kind of labyrinthine system that's being used to shield their financial dealings from scrutiny. And then we don't know whether or not tax evasion or avoidance is taking place because we can't see it, and we just have to take their word at face value. Now, even if someone says, well, they're just using it to avoid detection and therefore avoid being undermined by their competitors, you have to then say the use of offshore financial secrecy is not a neutral thing, because what you're doing is legitimizing a system that is also being used as a way for people with more nefarious goals to funnel money across the world without it being accountable. So I just did a list of them, and there was terrorism, far-right extremism, corruption, tax evasion, arms dealing, just about everything under the sun that's illegal and people need to hide in order for it not to be traced. So why is this hypocritical, or why is this the performance of progression? Well, just over a year and a bit ago, in the last bit of 2018, Fries published an issue, issue 199, which I've dubbed the decolonial issue, in which they sought to tackle what it is to decolonize culture. So on the front page, there was a statement in all capitals saying, "Decolonizing culture, where do we go from here?" And now, not one of the people that they solicited to write, or not one of their regular editors or contributors, spoke about Fries's use of offshore secrecy jurisdictions, their implications for continuing the legacy of colonial activity around the world. And and so basically I was trying to show how this is a textbook example of the performance of progression. On the one hand, a magazine can talk about decolonization, but then it completely sidesteps its own complicity in the literal and real and actual continuance of the colonial project.
Is that comparable in any way to sort of something like BP sponsorship of the Tate? Would that be, you know, their acceptance of that funding and attachment to that, or is that just another example?
I mean, I suppose it's a slightly different example, but I think the thing is, what we have to remember is that Fries operates at a much smaller scale, yes, than something like the Tate, and especially let's take it from the level of contributors. So I've had lots of discussions with some of the contributors to Fries who try to say that they have no moral attachment to how Fries operates. And the thing is, people are operating according to choice, because Fries magazine pays basically roughly the same amount of money that all other magazines pay to contributors to write. So there's a conscious decision by some people to put their cultural capital in with an organization that has questionable links to offshore financial secrecy jurisdictions, as opposed to putting it somewhere else. Yeah. I think that's something that should be looked at and scrutinized properly. But then also, we're talking about an organization that also has a choice about how it operates and where it puts its finance. So it's not then saying, Fries isn't this company that's saying, well, we're trying to operate as best we can and we need to get sponsorship from somewhere else. It's a commercial company. It's not a non-for-profit entity. Its bottom line is the accruement of revenue for its shareholders.
Yes.
So it is kind of distinct from the Tate, in that Tate's argument is that we have to secure sponsorship from corporate entities in order to match some funding that we get from the public to deliver artistic excellence. Fries is just a commercial industry that wants to make money and is using the cover of contemporary art to sort of inoculate itself against critique, basically.
It does sound inoculation, that the title of that piece, you know, decolonizing culture, where do you go from here? You know, it's like, you look over here, guys, we're doing this while we're doing that over there, perhaps you could say.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And that seems to be the behavior that's repeated throughout the sector in this new phase, this new sensibility of performing progression.
Documentary 15. We're getting close to, we're not out of time, but we're getting nearer the time we've got. Very interesting who's appointed to select and curate Documentary 15 in 2022.
Yeah, so what I wanted to do was then move from this more kind of a bureaucratic or incarnation of the colonial legacy to one that is actual, proper, real colonial activity in process. So basically, as an organisation called Ruhn Grupa have been selected to curate Documenta 15 in 2022. And so far, the art world, that is magazines, curators, people who are commentating on how things are changing, are celebrating the internationalism of the appointment. So it's fantastic that we have a group from Indonesia. We've never had a group from Indonesia before. Southeast Asia are finally becoming like actors on the main stage in the art world. And there's also talk about kind of addressing colonial legacies, all the usual rhetoric that accompanies these sorts of performances of progression. And the elephant in the room is that Indonesia is a country that is in that is colonizing another country as we speak.
That country's
West Papua, yeah. So basically, Indonesia, 5 years after something called the Bandung Conference was held in Bandung, Indonesia in 1955, six years after that, Indonesia colonized West Papua forcefully. Yeah. And they did it brutally. And it's been colonized since then to now. There's many, many like liberation movements. It's not like a passive occupation. The general populace in West Papua do not want Indonesia there, in the same way that the East Timorese didn't want Indonesia and East Timor. So for people who might remember that East Timor was fighting for independence, I think they were colonized in 75 by Indonesia.
Right.
And they were fighting for independence and finally got it in 1999. And at the same time, West Papua were being much more vocal about wanting their independence and were brutally shut down. So we can't really go into full details about that situation. But what you'll notice is that around the appointment of Ruhan Grupa, there is no discussion at all of the colonization of West Papua by Indonesia and the continued brutal suppression of liberation movements in that country.
Encouraging them in your piece, you are trying, I think, to encourage them to do that, to refer to.
Yeah. That. So I'm not. I'm definitely not trying to just have a go for the sake of it. I'm trying to provoke them into. You know, it could be that in the guise of rebuffing me, they could finally engage with it. It could be that they're under a regime that's not allowing them to speak freely. But I mean, all of this is speculation. What we can see, you know, I don't know, but what we can see from their actions is that they're not engaging with this so far. Mm-hmm. And in all the interviews that have taken place with Western publications, not one word about West Papua has been spoken. And this continues to happen every time people organize conferences to discuss the so-called the post-colonial legacy that followed all the decolonial movements that happened like in the post-war in the 20th century. People rarely discuss the actual colonization of West Papua.
Yeah.
So really this whole thing is to try to expose the fiction of this radicalizing prefix. It has nothing to do with decolonization. You know, if what they're just talking about is like, we need to have more different faces in high places. Well, that's, you know, that's been an imperative since 1990. The fact that it still hasn't happened, what does that say about the UK and its willingness to change? I mean, it says that obviously something more is happening and that this willingness isn't there. And maybe that was a kind of like pseudo progressivism that was happening all the way back then.
Yes.
So really the article is trying to get people to discuss this, man, and trying to get people to realize that as much as they bang on about how we need to like decolonize photography, or we need to like decolonize fashion, or we need to decolonize, I don't know, barbershops. Like there's actual people who are being brutalized in the world at the moment, and they need our help, not, you know, so, and it's not to try to, I'm saying that the least we can do is have these twin entreaties operating with a decent level of parity, right? At the moment, all we hear about is how we need this sort of symbolic decolonization visited on these like worthless institutions like the Oscars or the BAFTAs. And alongside that, we don't have these other voices talking about actual situations in places like West Papua.
Yeah.
Why can't they have an equal playing field?
Absolutely.
And I think, you know, I think that's necessary. And I think the reason why it isn't happening is telling about what it is that the sort of established part of the art world is trying to avoid. And it's trying to avoid accountability.
Thank you very much.